Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Ailsa Mellon Bruce was the only daughter of Andrew Mellon, the founder of the National Gallery of Art and a patron of the gallery since 1941. Through direct donation and various funds, she was responsible for the gallery's acquisition of many major works, including Ginevra de Benci by Leonardo. At her death in 1969, she left 153 paintings, primarily by French artists, to the gallery. For the 1978 opening of the East Building, selected paintings from the collection were shown as a memorial exhibition under the title Small French Paintings from the Bequest of Ailsa Mellon Bruce. In this lecture, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the East Building, Eric Denker, senior lecturer at the National Gallery of Art, describes the exhibition, a great favorite among visitors that would continue in various forms for 35 years. The show included jewel-like works by, among others, Corot, Manet, Degas, Boudin, Seurat, and Toulouse-Lautrec.
I'm Eric Denker with the staff of the Education Division, and this is the last of six lectures this summer devoted to celebrating the 40th anniversary of the East Building. 2 weeks ago, I was here to talk to you about some of the great exhibitions that have taken place in the East Building over that period of time. And one of the exhibitions that I mentioned was one of the opening exhibitions for the East Building 40 years ago this summer, and that was of small French paintings from the bequest of Ailsa Mellon Bruce. It was a long-running exhibition. After the initial exhibition, we tended to call it an installation, so you won't find it in the archives of exhibitions under each year. It ran on and off for 35 years until 2013, and is arguably one of the most popular exhibitions that we have ever had. It is largely from the collection during that period of time from Ailsa Mellon Bruce, who is the, if I can put it this way, unsung member of the circle that make up the founders of the National Gallery. And so today I want to talk to you about who Ailsa Mellon Bruce was. I want to talk to you about how she formed her collection, how absolutely essential she is to understanding the collection as we see it today, and to talk about the evolution of that exhibition up to essentially the present day. Ailsa was the only daughter of Pittsburgh banker and National Gallery founder Andrew W. Mellon and his wife Nora McMullen Mellon. They were divorced in 1912. In 1920, Andrew left Pittsburgh to serve as Secretary of the Treasury in Washington, a post that he held until 1932. He was the ambassador to Great Britain to the Court of St. James from 1932 to March of 1933, after which he moved back to his native city of Pittsburgh. The remainder of his life was devoted to philanthropy. Mellon had been a keen collector of art. He bought his first paintings around 1880 during a trip to Europe with Henry Clay Frick of the now-renowned Frick Collection. Inspired by London's National Gallery, Mellon had the idea of turning his collection into the foundation of the National Gallery of Art in Washington. In 1930, he therefore established the A.W. Mellon Educational and Charitable Trust, the medium through which he made his gift to the nation. Mellon returned to Washington in 1937 for the purpose of overseeing construction, but he died in that summer, 4 years before our official opening. Ailsa was born in 1901. She was 6 years older than her brother Paul, who we have celebrated many times for his contributions to the National Gallery. He remembered her as a high-spirited tomboy as a young girl. And there she is, as you would see her in the image by Philippe de Laszlo from 1926, that is generally hanging in our founder's room in the West Building. Her mother left her father when Ailsa was 11 in a bitterly contested divorce. Her father tended to be rather aloof and emotionally distant to her. She attended boarding school and later Miss Porter School for Girls in Farmington, Connecticut. and as a teenager, she spent her summers in Europe. When Elsa was 20, she moved with her father to Washington, that would be 1921, where Elsa acted as his official hostess for the next dozen years. There is Andrew Mellon alongside Elsa and Paul. There you see her as a young girl on the left, then a little bit later on in her 20s on the right. When Andrew Mellon moved to Washington, he moved into the McCormick Building. This building is at the corner of 18th and Massachusetts Avenue. Famously, Lord Duveen, the art dealer, moved into apartments above them later on. In 1926, she married David Bruce, member of an old Southern family, who then worked as vice counsel for the State Department and later became also the ambassador to the Court of St. James in London. The Bruces divorced in 1945. They had one child, Audrey. Audrey married Stephen Currier, with whom she had three children. But Audrey and Stephen were presumed dead in 1967 when a plane in which they were flying was lost in the Caribbean. Elsa only survived 2 years after that tragic loss. She died in 1969. With her brother, Elsa Mellon Bruce was the co-founder of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. In 1940, she established the Avalon Foundation, which made grants to colleges and universities, medical schools and hospitals, youth programs and community services, environmental projects, an array of cultural and arts organizations, including the National Gallery of Art. From its creation through the end of 1968, when it ceased to exist, the Avalon Foundation awarded more than $67 million, a significant portion supporting organizations in the New York area where she lived, including the grant for the creation of Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. The Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, founded under the laws of the state of New York, was formed on June 30th in 1969 through the consolidation of the two existing foundations, the Avalon Foundation, which she had founded in 1940, and the Old Dominion Foundation, which Paul Mellon had founded in 1941. And so the two together became the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. And Elsa died on August 25th, 1969, just 49 years ago, shortly after that foundation was founded. At her death in 1969, she bequeathed 153 paintings, primarily by French artists, to the National Gallery, as well as establishing a fund for future acquisitions. But she had been a longtime patron of the National Gallery, starting back with our opening in 1941. She had a particularly close relationship to John Walker, the second director of the National Gallery, who used to visit her in her apartment in New York, as well as in various estates. And Walker remembered her in his memoirs, and that's why I've left this photograph in front. Walker said, "If about Paul there is an aura of happiness, about his sister Elsa there was always one of sadness. It was as though a wicked fairy had appeared at her christening, waved a wand and blighted all future enjoyment of her wealth and beauty. Yet, those of us lucky enough to have penetrated her shyness knew a woman who could be as gay and amusing as her brother. But we also realized that for years she was in constant pain from a form of arthritis, that in her personal life there were repeated tragedies." One last set of remarks about her character, however, and these are the Elsa Mellon Bruce Decorative Arts Galleries at the Carnegie Institute in Pittsburgh. Her brother, at an opening in 1976, said, "I would like you all to see her through my eyes, as a happy child, an attractive young woman, a concerned wife and mother and grandmother, as well as an intelligent philanthropist and a collector of rare discernment and taste, a dear companion and a charming human being." Her contributions to the National Gallery are largely unsung, but through personal donation, the Elsa Mellon Bruce Fund, and the Avalon Foundation, she was a major factor in making the collection as we know it today. It was Elsa in 1941 who gave the portrait of Andrew Mellon that hangs in the Founders Room by Oswald Burley. Later, in 1961, she gave The Young Girl Reading by Fragonard, and you will see a certain leitmotif that she often gave images of young women in various different activities. We know that on this occasion, she wrote that this was a gift of Mrs. Mellon Bruce in memory of her father, Andrew W. Mellon. But it started a decade of the most amazing acquisitions. In 1962, the Elsa Mellon Bruce Fund paid for The Lute Player by Orazio Gentileschi, one of the important Baroque paintings in our collection. In 1965, the Elsa Mellon Bruce Fund provided the money for Daniel in the Lion's Den by Rubens. In 1966, the fund provided the funds for the Roger van der Weyden St. George and the Dragon. In 1967, the fund provided for the acquisition of the only Leonardo in public hands in this hemisphere, the Ginevra da Benci. 2 years later, we added this painting, the year that she died, from funds from the Elsa Mellon Bruce Fund for The Judgment of Paris by Claude Lorrain. And even posthumously, we added The Voyage of Life by Thomas Cole. I'm showing you just one from the set. Those are just from the Elsa Mellon Bruce Fund. Because in fact, from the Avalon Foundation, which she had founded and where she sat on the board and was very, very active, we also received The Return of the Prodigal Son by Murillo, Right Left by Winslow Homer, Autumn on the Hudson by Jasper David Cropsey, and funds that she left for further acquisitions at her death allowed us to collect also in 20th century art. So both the Femme Nue by Picasso and the Lavender Mist by Pollock, two of the most important pieces in the 20th century collection, both came by way of those funds. However, a pivotal moment in her collecting career came in 1955 with the purchase of an individual collection, a collection that was from Captain Edward Mullinux. Who was Mullinux? I'm showing you here on the right. He was a British couturier who began in fashion design in 1911. After serving in World War I, when he lost an eye, Mullinux opened his own fashion house in Paris in November of 1919, quickly expanding to Monte Carlo, Cannes, and later on in London. He was known for an impeccably refined simplicity. He was, as historian Caroline Milbank wrote, the designer to whom a fashionable woman would turn if she wanted to be absolutely right without being utterly predictable in the 20s and 30s. He frowned on superfluous decoration. He regularly dressed European royals. He was a great favorite with trend-setting actresses, including Greta Garbo, Marlene Dietrich, Gertrude Lawrence, Margaret Leighton, and Vivian Leigh. And protégés included Christian Dior and Pierre Balmain. He had collected as a painter since the 1920s. He himself was a painter, and four of his paintings are now in the collection, and they came not from his collection, but they were purchased separately from the Hammer Galleries in 1965 by Elsa Mellon Bruce. We know that his collection was shown at the National Gallery and at the Museum of Modern Art in 1952. Under John Walker's guidance, Elsa bought the whole collection of 73 paintings in 1955 for $950,000. and the intent was always that they would come here to the National Gallery. She wasn't content to leave it at that. She continued to add to her post-impressionist collection during the remaining 14 years of her life, adding works by Boudin, a favorite of her and her brother, and adding works by Pissarro, Monet, and Vuillard. And so, to talk about a number of the individual works, what I want to mention here is some of the larger Old Master and Impressionist works that came in with her bequest in 1970. So, from Wildenstein, she had purchased in 1959 the Marchesa di Cinchon, Goya's work of 1783. We know that she also purchased Turner's Rotterdam Ferry Boat, but this was a gift from her father in 1937. From Knoedler, she had purchased this Renoir from 1872, and this was purchased just the year after the Mullinux purchase, a major image within our 19th century French collection. It shows Paris looking south just after the Franco-Prussian War, treating the Pont Neuf as a magnificent thoroughfare as we go from the right bank across the Ile de la Cité to the left bank, and the variety of different people and types that would cross the bridge. It was important for her that we added this to collection. She understood that it was a signature early Renoir and quite different from the Renoirs that were in the Mullinux collection. Here, from the second floor, he depicts policemen, he depicts working class, he depicts shop boys, the Boulevardier, and because all of these people move back and forth across the bridge quite quickly, we know that he sent his brother down into the street to ask directions, to ask the time, to make people pause, and so he includes his brother here and here. And among the very major paintings that were added to the French collection, certainly Monet's Artist Garden at Verteuil, bought from Wildenstein in 1961, is important. So these are other paintings that came in the bequest, but they're all quite large and they were integrated into the permanent collection of the West Building. In addition, the bequest included a lot of prints and drawings, including these two Sargent watercolors. But these were not included in that opening exhibition from the bequest. Here's the cover of the catalog from that exhibition. There were 59 works in the exhibition. 49 had come from the Mullinux collection, and I'll mention those which she then added along the way. And here was the layout. And the layout started, this is just above us over here. The layout started, here's the entrance, there was the elevator. And you came into room one, and you had your first difficulty in choosing whether to go left or whether to go right. The exhibition was not, strictly speaking, chronological. In fact, you got into trouble if you were trying to see it chronologically by going back and forth. So generally you came in here and you would circle, these are the ways the rooms were numbered. Room 5 was not used for many years. This was simply closed off as a wall for many years. But you generally came into the front room and stopped and had to decide whether or not you would go left or right. Among the earliest paintings that you would have seen would have been this painting, which is by Corot, this river scene by Corot, which has the curiosity of having been signed twice, down over here by Corot. It shows the delicate color palette of Corot in a very experimental part of his career, where he was avoiding sharp contrasts of dark and light and allowing the colors of the water to be picked up, as he did in this as well, both in the sky and down in the water as well. You can see that. So the color of the sky is picked up, and then the sandy color of the bridge reflected down in the water and the sand here as well. There were works by Manet. And this is one of the works that she had added to the Mullinux collection. There were a whole series of paintings of dogs early on. Most of them came from a friend in the circle of the Impressionists and Manet, whose name was Comte Ludovic Napoleon Lepic. You may know him as well as a printmaker who we've shown in the past. He was the breeder of dogs, and this King Charles Spaniel is a wonderful example of the kind of work that Manet was doing. But we also got this very late image, this still life, with just a few flowers in this crystal vase, and how careful and delicately painted they are, Manet, in the last few months of his life when he does these still lives. Major additions to the collection included works that had come directly from the family. We know that Mullinux sometimes went directly to descendants and to the estates. And so we have some very interesting provenance, history of collecting. This is an image that is by Berthe Marisot. It's of her sister Edma. And Edma was also a painter until she married and then gave it up. This is done in 1869. Edma is probably expecting at this moment as she sits there by the window. She was a favorite model for Berthe Marisot. And so there were a number of Marisots that came. This one complemented something that had come in the collection as well. The work that you see here, which is a Chester Dale painting, which shows Marisot's mother and sister, again, probably during this period when she was expecting. And then the marvelous masterpiece of Marisot's that was in the first Impressionist exhibition. It was, in fact, a painting that was a gift from Berthe Marisot to Manet, and it forms an important element in our larger collection of Berthe Marisot, some of the paintings much larger than this. It is an image at the harbor at Lorient, and we see, once again, her sister sitting there. But notice how Marisot was very adept at playing with perspective and understood that if you focused on something in the distance, that what was in the foreground was going to be out of focus. So she doesn't detail her sister. It's not intended that you recognize her. Instead, it's the rigging and the windows and the architecture where we're focused. An important addition to the collection. There were just two pastels included in that original exhibition of 59 works. They were by Degas. The two of them that you see here being not only exceptional works, but also having a distinguished provenance. So the one on the left of the view of the stage from backstage was actually owned by Antonin Proust at one point. And it was a gift from Andrew Mellon to his daughter back in the 1930s. They set up the comparison, and then one of the other works that was included was this work. And this is a work that did not come from the Mullinux collection, but that she added on her own. In 1948, she bought this from Carstairs Gallery. And again, it has a distinguished provenance because it was once owned by the arch critic and defender of Impressionism, Theodore Duret. And there's Duret in a painting that is from our Chester Dale collection, just so you can see that. Both she and her brother were very fond of Boudin, Eugène Boudin, always credited by Monet as his first teacher down in along the Normandy coast. She had collected him before she knew of Mullinux's collection. This is a work that she had owned already by 1942 and had bought from a private collector. And it is of fisher people on the shore near Etretat, and that's the very characteristic architectural arch over there in the water. She also had already owned this from the dealer Linden Gallery in 1947, the figures on the beach at Berwick. But suddenly, when she acquired the Mullinux collection, she added works of the beach from Trouville or from Deauville. And this harbor scene, and it's harbor scenes such as this, and this is one that she acquired separately from Wildenstein a decade after the large purchase. She bought this because she realized that this is the kind of painting that allows us to see the indebtedness, looking at this Boudin, of Monet. And these were hanging side by side for many years, so you could really understand the full thrust of the relationship between Boudin as the first teacher and his pupil Monet. She also added this stunning view of Argenteuil from Wildenstein in 1966, in the same year. And so we get a greater and greater critical mass of these early Impressionist paintings. In addition to the Marceau, the Pizarro, which she bought from in 1960 from Saint-Saulves, was also, this orchard field at Louveciennes, was also in the first Impressionist exhibition. Now we have a density of paintings that were in the Impressionist exhibitions that were so pivotal to the avant-garde art of the 19th century. She had a number of Renoirs, most of them came from the Mullinux collection, including this, the Regatta at Argenteuil, and the Madame Monet and her son. And this is a painting that has a distinguished provenance because it was painted alongside Manet and Monet and then given as a gift by Renoir to Monet, since it represents Madame Monet and her son. Now, these are two of the really outstanding Renoirs that were added to the collection. Unfortunately, Mullinux had bought a whole series of late sketches by Renoir that are perhaps not quite up to the same standard. And I'm showing you two. I won't leave them up for very long so that you're not damaged psychically. But they are truly execrable works. And these are two that I picked out from a whole series that were on display in that first exhibition. Now, in the late 1960s, John Walker and others had gone to Elsa Mellen Bruce and mentioned which paintings they wanted. In the end, they weren't able to distinguish between those that they had not wanted in the gift, and so we have a large collection of Renoir, and some of them quite beautiful, but others which you won't see very often on the walls. Included in almost every one of the venues, one of the revivals of the exhibition, would have been the Toulouse-Lautrecs here that are quite early. And so Toulouse-Lautrec's dog, Flesh, on the left was done when he was 17 years old. Or the portrait that you see on the right, which is of Jean Gaudin, is when he was just coming to Paris when he's 21 years old. And so we had good early examples. And one of the characteristics in the exhibition tended to be that there were a lot of examples from early in artists' careers. A nice addition to the collection, since we don't have a large work by Georges Seurat, post-impressionist artist, was this image, which was a study for the Sunday afternoon on the island of the Grand Jatte. And it's lovely, it's on display right now amidst a whole set of smaller sketches by Seurat over in the West Building, recently given from Paul Mellon and his wife, Bunny. And among the post-impressionist masterpieces in Mullinux's collection, certainly we should acknowledge the Van Gogh that you see here of the field in Arles. But in some ways, the core of the collection, by way of post-impressionist artists, was of Bonnard and Vuillard. And so we have these early Bonnards from when he's in his 20s, mid-20s. For instance, the children going home from school, that utter dependence on surface two-dimensionality as part of the design aesthetic, essentially deriving from both Japanese prints and from aspects of the developing post-impressionist aesthetics. Black figures against a brown board with just a little bit of lighter colors around to enliven the scene. Or the Bonnard here of the two dogs in the street. Again, it's extraordinarily two-dimensional. There's very little depth here. We get the street, perhaps a curb, the shapes and patterns of the dogs and a wheelbarrow, and then a facade without seeing the tops or sides of these buildings, so that we concentrate on the basic two-dimensional geometry of these windows and this opening in what I believe is a very Vermeer-esque approach, if you think back to the street scene in Delft, but brought up to date. There were a whole series of works by Vuillard on display, including this from 1891, when the artist was about 20 years old, with the little girl in the red scarf. I have argued for 40 years that it's not red. It is, however, a marvelous example of what we were talking about in terms of two-dimensionality, where the figure of the man is cropped, his head, his arm, the other leg are cropped in the way that both photography and Japanese color woodblock prints would have inspired. We get these nice patterns here, but they are flat. We don't get a sense of rounding of form. And it's difficult to understand exactly what he intended. Perhaps this, again, is a curb. Maybe these are people walking on the street, another curb. But instead, we get a beautiful decorative two-dimensional pattern. As we do here, and this we are of women drinking coffee from about the same time, where it's even a little bit difficult to tell where one woman ends and the second figure begins. They simply blend, as they blend with the table and the background, as you blend with the patterns. These all came from the Mullinux collection, but this one she added individually. In 1959, she purchased this at Wildenstein, and it quickly became a great favorite. It is the artist's paint box in the studio. And you get a chance to see the paint box, the roses, the books on the table, and all of it's placed against the decoration of either doors or wall decorations back here. The mellow colors pick it out as very different from the brighter colors that we saw that were from a little bit earlier in his career. And so you can see that what you often had were views through doorways into the next room. And here, we're in the first room, we're looking into the second room, which often was dominated by Barbizon painting and smaller paintings. And then the third room that you see back here. I should mention one other work from that original selection, and that was the Matisse that you see here, the Fauve painting from 1905 of this still life, which seems so very different from much of what we've been seeing. And again, when you first came in, now imagine the space that you see here only had 59 paintings during the opening. So it was done in a way where there were relatively few paintings in each room. And so gradually, what began to happen was that with each curator, they would add paintings to the exhibitions. They would change the hanging. Occasionally, the exhibition would close and have to move to another space in the East Building, often on the ground floor. But normally, at this point, what you would have found is relatively dark paintings in this room that included Corot and Daumier, a room that had a lot of Barbizon images here, the room with Bonnard and Vuillard, different selections, but almost always Manet, Fantin, Latour, Marceau, very often on this alcove, and then you would find Impressionists, Monet, Sisley, Pizarro, Boudin, and others. So in fact, it didn't have any kind of clear circuit. And then they opened this room up to be used for a little while for prints that matched what was being shown in the paintings galleries. So paintings such as these began to show up from the Chesterdale Fund, the work by Boyer, a great favorite of Philip Conisbee, who did an exhibition in this space, or the exceptional academic work by Jean-Jacques Tissot, Hide and Seek. One of the great favorites over the many years when it was on display, one of our few examples of academic painting at a time when the Impressionists are playing off against the careful brushwork and detail and narrative of academic painting. But being over in the East Building, it wasn't seen as often in the context of the great Impressionist paintings as in some of these smaller French paintings. As far as I can tell, it has not been on view in the recent past, although it was a great favorite of the audience. The same is true of this work by Cazin, and we have added a number of works by Cazin. This one was not from the Mullinox collection. It was bought by Elsa Mellon Bruce, but from Carstairs back in 1943. And this painting, which Elsa Mellon Bruce bought in 1943 in Paris, and it's by an artist who was lesser known for many years, but is beginning to get his due now. It is by Jean Béraud, and Béraud was an academic artist in the 1880s and 1890s, and this is a superb small example of his work, Paris Street. More often you saw works by Daumier, this work being given to us by Duncan Phillips, or Corot, and this reminds us that Paul Mellon also collected in this area, and this is from Paul Mellon's collection. But if we go back and talk about Corot, we can also go back to the Widners and to others. And of course, Chester Dale would have contributed a certain number of these smaller paintings as well. The work that you see here is a work that was representative of one of our really, I think, most significant curators of French painting over the years, Philip Conisbee, the late Philip Conisbee, who added this by way of the Permanent Patrons Fund. It is a work by Corot, and it is the image of the bridge and island of San Bartolomeo, the bridges and islands of San Bartolomeo, one of the last of the Roman paintings by Corot that was left in public collections. He also added the Rousseau of this panoramic view of the Île-de-France. And those were added to paintings that were already here. The Old Oak by Dupré that had been given to us by Horace Gallatin back in the 40s. But one of the things that began to happen was we also began to have other than French paintings. So this is a work by the Dutch artist Jean Keen, The Towpath, that was given to us by the Mellon family back in 2006. And so, with that, and the addition of that Gallery 5 to house a few prints, I'm showing you two by Pizarro, a monotype from about 1890, as well as an etching, that in fact, with apologies to Edward Gibbon, the exhibition was no longer either small or French or paintings. Here's an installation shot that shows the kitchen maid there in the center in the kitchen by Berthe Morisot amidst works by Renoir, and there are two of the better small Renoirs on either side there. And through the doorway, you can see the Duré. Again, we were no longer finding that everything had to be small. Or the Cézanne and Van Gogh that flank either side of the doorway looking into the Barbizon room with the works that you see by Millet, Corot, and others. There was, after a while, always a section devoted to Fantin-Latour. And these weren't particularly diminutive paintings, although there were times when there were small paintings included. Instead, this very impressive, strong still life that's a very realist image was there, and it was generally next to this very small painting of Peaches from 1868. You can sense the kind of ripeness and even the sense of the fuzz on the surface of these peaches. And it generally made an excellent contrast to the Manet still life that was often near it. On the other side, often Fantin Latour's Sonia was shown. Again, a rather large-scale painting for the exhibition, but one that played nicely into the contrast, again, with Manet and with Berthe Morisot. Sometimes the small French paintings would be used for potential acquisitions. That was the case with this painting, which did not enter the collection. It is a large-scale Cazin, which is of the quarry of Monsieur Pascal near Nanterre. We have acquired a whole set of paintings by Cazin with the acquisition of the Corcoran Gallery's collection, and so it is less likely that this one might come to us. And of course, small paintings by Van Gogh fit in either building. Here, Rouland's Baby, a painting that he did in 1888. So this was the configuration that I've shown you several times. Remember that sometimes I've mentioned that we moved to the other side of the building, and so here was an installation. You can see the painting by Pizarro through to the left, and over here on the right, the image that is by Monet that we've already seen. And you can always tell the photographs of the installations and other parts of the building because they don't have the same molding that existed, and the colors of the wall, the carpeting, everything is quite different. And it was often refreshing to see the paintings in a different context. This is what you would see upstairs today after the renovation. And so there are no longer three galleries along here because of the addition of this elevator. And so there is the original gallery, is about the same size and shape, but this one has been truncated. And now you go into a separate space here, and there is an alcove where there are two paintings by Georges Braque. And where originally that Gallery 5 was, this is now the stairwell. And as you go through, you can see the rooms that are devoted to various different figures. These are largely intact, this side. These are the ones that have been changed the most. It includes a selection of paintings that in many ways make us reminisce, make us nostalgic, if you will, for the installation of small French paintings. So that this first gallery is mostly given over to Bonnard and Vuillard. And sometimes they were in this room and sometimes they had been back here. And then the second room to Bonnard and Matisse and Fauvism. And then a variety of different works show up here by Dufy and Utrillo and others. Picasso and Braque dominate this room. And finally, one of the great Modigliani galleries in the world, upstairs with this variety of work, sometimes including the sculpture and sometimes not. When we speak of the great founders of the National Gallery, we speak with great deference to the 150 works that came from Andrew Mellon, approximately 125 paintings and 25 works of sculpture. We talk about Samuel and Rush Kress as two important benefactors. We mention Joseph Widener and the Widener family for their great collections of Renaissance and Baroque painting. And we often talk about Chester Dale and the immense importance, 1963, of the Chester Dale bequest. But we should equally, I think, laud the efforts of Elsa Mellon Bruce, even as we think of the Small French Painting Show as a past history, but to think not only of those paintings which she had accumulated, but all of the other paintings that have been given to the collection over the years by way of her personally, by way of the Avalon Foundation, largely in American art, and by way of the Elsa Mellon Bruce Fund, which continues to provide funds for us for acquisitions today. When she was quite young, 1930, she was in her late 20s, her father formed the foundation with the idea of giving a gift to the nation. One of the paintings that she cared deeply about was by Joshua Reynolds' Lady Caroline Howard. She was heartbroken when he said that he was going to give it to the National Gallery. It had been hanging in her bedroom in the McCormick Building for many years, and he didn't understand how close she had become to this painting. He offered this particular bit of wisdom, that the gift to the National Gallery and to the nation was not a gift from him, it was a gift for the family, because great paintings shouldn't be for the delectation of a few, but for the many. She understood this, although she never completely got over it. We know that early on she thought of trying to trade with the National Gallery to get it back, somehow finding a way to get it back. But she overcame that to become one of the great patrons of the arts of the 20th century. And I think she deserves every bit of credit for taking the place in the Founders Room that she so richly deserves. Thanks so much for coming today.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.